striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR News. Next Thursday morning at 7, you can make WILL a better radio station by helping to raise a whole day's worth of money in just 1 hour, the kickoff hour for WILL's Fall Membership Week. That's it, just 1 hour of fundraising for the entire day. To help make that work, a generous group of WILL listeners is offering to match your contribution dollar for dollar. So you get more of the programs you tune in for, and WILL gets the money it needs to bring you those programs. Please help keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. And call with your contribution Thursday morning at 7. And thanks.
Today's programs are made possible with support from the Champaign-Urbana Tenant Union, helping people resolve housing problems for more than 30 years. The Tenant Union is a proud member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org. WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at will.illinois.edu and on HD Radio at 90.9 FM HD 2 and HD 3. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon for the program. The onset is swift, sudden psychosis. What's happening? What to do? How to pull through? What will tomorrow bring? Today, we're going to hear the story of a young woman who, at the age of 15, as her father describes it, was struck mad. Michael Greenberg says his daughter Sally's illness marked a turning point in both their lives. He says it was like being, in his words, in the presence of a rare force of nature, such as a great blizzard or flood. Destructive, but in its way astounding, too. Michael Greenberg, author of the memoir Hurry Down Sunshine, is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions and comments. You can join our discussion with a phone call. The number is in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Michael Greenberg is a columnist for the London Times Literary Supplement. He's the author of fiction, criticism, and travel pieces. His book, Hurry Down Sunshine, is published by Other Press. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Michael Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
It was a stifling hot day in July of 1996 when Sally was enveloped in psychosis. Would you tell us about that day?
Well, yes, it was one of those sweltering New York days that just seemed to be a bit out of time. And it was also a weekend when most people are out of the city. So it did have a kind of a patina of difference and that day, even if things had been normal. Sally had been, I would say, percolating for some days, but nothing that seemed to me or to her stepmother, Pat, my wife, completely out of the ordinary of, say, adolescent transformation that occurs. She's 15, and she had been reading incessantly, notating Shakespeare's sonnets, looking up words, listening to Bach's Goldberg variations on her Walkman. In those days, the Walkman. This is 1996. Also, in a continuous loop, very wired, very alive, and I actually thought, wow, this is the intellectual awakening of my beautiful daughter. Isn't this amazing? She was a bit peevish, her voice a bit pressured, but again, the irritations of adolescence with their parents. However, on July 5th, this had been going on for a few days, on July 5th, a transformation occurred that was unignorable. She became actually another person, and her speech was completely different. It had a kind of a phony, recorded quality that seemed to be coming out of another part of her being that I was completely unfamiliar with. She was irritable and bristling and exploding with energy. She had a vision, as she described it, of a world explaining vision, as she thought of it, which was that we were all born geniuses, that the great geniuses of history, such as Shakespeare or Bach, whom she had been engaged with at that time, or any of the other great geniuses, were merely people who had managed to hold on to their childhood gift, to their infant gift that we're all given at birth, and that the rest of us had had it drummed out of us by the mundane profanity of living, the contract of existence, as it were, and that if she could impart this to people, she could save the world from all the suffering that it undergoes. And this often happens with mania. A great explosive vision overcomes the person in manic psychosis. She's tried to stop cars, stop strangers on the street, to tell them, to impart this vision, to give them this gift. And of course, what they saw was a girl out of control, and they would push past and ignore her. And she was brought home by the police with a friend who was with her, who was as bewildered as could be, this friend. And we realized after some hours of trying to absorb this stabbing transformation and kind of sense of an alien person, suddenly this my daughter, who was close to me as our children are, as close as anyone, who has learned to speak from me, really, who had learned her first stories from me, whose frame of reference is so enveloped with mine, is suddenly impenetrable. And it was stunning and stabbing, and after some hours we realized we had to take her to the emergency room.
Yeah, it was your wife Pat, Sally's stepmom, who was first to understand that this was very serious. This was acute psychosis.
Well, yes, it was. It was Pat. I was so emotionally impacted by it that it was hard for me to have even a modicum of detachment and objectivity, and to see what really objectively was happening to Sally. Pat, as her stepmother, was able to step back, as it were, and see that something was seriously wrong. I wanted to believe it was drugs, which normally would be very upsetting to a parent, and it would have been upsetting to me, but in this instance seemed like a saving explanation, because perhaps she had taken some psychedelic or something, and it would supply an explanation, and most importantly, a temporary explanation.
Yeah.
But Pat saw that this wasn't so.
Yeah. Your family is so fortunate to have Pat in your lives. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, yes, we are fortunate to have Pat. And in a way, Pat is the hero of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I met Pat when she very fortuitously came into my life as a roommate. So she was a stranger. And as roommates, we were sharing a kitchen. And we began to find these points of intellectual connection. And I began to become very drawn to her. She's a choreographer. I know she was at the time. She's changed since. Under the influence of Sally's illness, she has now changed professions and become an expert in infant development, and works in a NICU unit and does other things with infants. And this is partly very much because of the impact Sally's condition had on her. And she was a choreographer, lived a very ascetic life, the ascetic monastic life of the New York artist who has no money, and just had a kind of a, and still has a kind of a spine of strength and perception that cuts through the cobwebs of emotion at the most critical moments. I would say the perfect person to have with you in a crisis.
Yeah. Very perceptive and very finely tuned instincts, if I could call them that. You talked a moment ago about when things were unfolding, just, you know, like a, not unfolding is not the right word. It's like a train crash or something, a train wreck. And you said it was impossible for you to be objective at the moment. But later, here you are in Hurry Down Sunshine, this book, and that metaphor that you use, that I used in my introduction, of being in the midst of a great force of nature, destructive and astounding. When were you able to see it that way?
Well, I was able to see it that way finally when the storm lifted in the fall, and I just felt, as we all did, exhausted and wrung out, as if this unexpected wind had come and it, you know, buffeted us from one place to the other, and now the wind has passed, and we're each hanging on in different parts of, say, the water where our boat has been destroyed, looking at each other, surprised to be alive and to have eyes. It was that kind of a thing. I mean, it just completely overtook us and Sally. And the book is really an attempt to tell the story of what effect this storm had on those closest to Sally. And but to really, really be able to write about it, it took me many, many years. And I really didn't start writing about it until about 3 years ago. I had taken notes because I'm a writer and I have my notebook, and I took notes during it, but never with the idea of actually writing something about it and exposing my family and myself to what perhaps is painless, is best left painlessly unsaid. But in the end, I did find the distance and the detachment to recreate the summer, which is what the challenge of the book was to me, to recreate the summer and to recreate the feeling of living in this kind of a crisis and what it does to you. Because I find that in a crisis, you know, you were talking about Pat and her extraordinary perceptions and her, how helpful she was to us. I think that in a crisis, I don't know if everyone feels this way or this is, or others will resonate with this, but we become ourselves, but more so. And so I realized that actually, in a way, in recreating the summer, I was writing a book that perhaps said something about human nature as well, and it's a dramatic narrative. And I felt that, I with trepidation, I continued after getting the permission of the principal characters involved, including Sally, of course. And I'm glad I did, because I feel it tells a story that perhaps is underrepresented in the great literature of mental illness, where almost all the fine books throughout history, going back to Richard Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy in the early 1700s, that those books are about people describing their experience of being psychotic. And this was kind of from the other shore.
Sally, no doubt, has read the book.
Yes, she has.
What does she think?
Well, I was very nervous giving her the book. I thought, what? You know, she had described her illness and her bouts of mania and as leaving her with a kind of amnesia a kind of merciful amnesia, she calls it, where she remembers insights and flashes, but can't remember much. So here I was giving her what is essentially the news about ourselves that we never get, really, is how others see us. Here I am giving Sally the news about herself in a transformed psychotic state, how all of us saw her. And I thought perhaps this could be damaging to her. Perhaps it could hurt her to read this, even though it was the furthest thing from my mind to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I was delighted at her response. She said, I love it. She called me after the week, spending the weekend with it. I was ready to go up to see her if she wanted to talk about it. And we had made all these elaborate plans, and she just called me and said, I love it. I felt like I was reading about someone else, a 15-year-old girl named Sally who had been to hell and was the only one who didn't know it.
Mm.
And I thought that was just an amazing response, typical of Sally's ability to sort of sum things up in kind of aphoristic brilliance, which is sometimes goes with mania, a facility of a certain kind.
Well, you know, your daughter, like you, has a great affinity for language. And it was interesting to me when fall approaches a dozen years ago, 1996, and she's getting ready to go back to school, she... while that amnesia might be merciful, on the other hand, she finds herself thinking, you know, feeling everybody else knows what happened but me.
Mm. Exactly. That amnesia is merciful on one level, but very scary on another, which is, what was I doing? How can I face people not knowing how I was behaving, only knowing that my behavior was outside the realm of the social contract? Outside the realm of socially acceptable behavior. She might have insulted people. She might have grabbed them. She might have been raging in front of them. She might have been speaking in non sequiturs in her oracular way. All the things that come with a manic attack. She had no idea. And she feared that. That is true. But she managed to work through it. And in effect, most of us protected her from the world while she was in the worst of her mania. And people in mania do need to be protected from the world, not just Sally, and not just because of social disgrace, but also because they can do things that are harmful to themselves.
Yeah. It was interesting in the hospital, when you took her to the ER and then she was hospitalized, that that was a hard lesson for you, that she needed to be isolated not only from other people in the hospital, but from her family.
Yes, that's right. As I remember, experienced it, that she was being locked away from those who were already locked away. So it was a kind of a second, third degree of isolation, and it just was stunning. And this is how she was now seen, that she had become a mental patient who needed to be isolated in what, in my imagination at the time, not knowing a great deal about mental illness or psychiatric wards, was just conjured the images of the ancient madhouse, of bedlam, of the isolation room, and the stigma and the pariah status that goes with this, and that every depiction of it practically in movies, etc., promotes, is one of a person who has kind of lost their humanity and is no longer treated as a human being. So this was Now, I want to say I'm not in the anti-psychiatry camp at all, and that this is not really what was happening. Sally was in what they call the quiet room, which is an isolated room, but I came to understand that she needed to be there for 24 hours at that time of her highest mania, and that it wasn't punitive necessarily. It was also protective for that short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that there's very little treatment for psychosis, and its underlying mechanisms, what it is as shrouded in mystery as it's been since we've dealt with it. And even despite the gains of brain science, it remains elusive. James Joyce, who had a schizophrenic daughter, Lucia, called it the most elusive disease known to man and unknown to medicine. And he said that in the 1930s, and unfortunately it's still true. There's been no breakthrough since the advent of Thorazine in 1952, and all the drugs since then are basic offshoots of that, and that is not a cure, it's a treatment. So mental health workers, psychiatrists, do the best they can, but this is an intractable condition. And whether it's a disease or not is even under question, because you know how we speak of disease in the sense that we say, I have cancer, I have diabetes. Even in the way we speak about mental illness, I am manic depressive, I am schizophrenic. It's almost as if we have an innate sense of it being part of the human spectrum, part of who we are. It's a function of who the person is in a certain kind of a way. And so it's a very mysterious, complicated thing that's been with us since recorded time that we all recognize when we see it. But what is it exactly?
It is identity in part. And at one point in the book, you write, we all fear at some point that our world and the world are hopelessly estranged.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That is a fear we all have, that we all live in subjectivity. And our struggle, our triumph as human beings is to be able to break out of our subjectivity enough to communicate, to have compassion, to trade ideas, to trade goods, to live the life of humanity, and to experience what I call the trick of agreement that we have, the trick of agreement that allows you and me to talk right at this moment and to have a basic agreement on what the words I'm saying and you're saying mean. And so we can exchange and go deeper. That disappears with psychosis. That trick of agreement is no longer there. And communication completely breaks down at a time when the person, the psychotic person, needs to communicate and is driven to communicate more than ever. So it's a very difficult condition. And it does speak to our own struggles to communicate, which is always, you know, not the easiest thing in the world.
Do you and your daughter talk about this, or have you talked about it? And how does she see it? How does she describe it?
Well, she...
This trick of agreement.
Yes, well, we do talk about it, and she has to contend with this. She has to contend with this possibility that the trick of agreement leaves her, and the isolation that comes with that, the isolation of being unable to speak with anyone, really, it's tremendously painful. She's become something of an expert of her disease, as she must become, as I think all people with psychosis lurking as a possibility in their lives must become an expert on it, to foresee it, to feel it coming on. The poet Robert Lowell, who suffered from severe manic attacks, was hospitalized 12, 15 times during his adult life. He used to say he could feel a tingle come up his spine, and he would know it was coming on. And it's a very diabolical thing, mania, because it seduces you in. It makes you feel omnipotent. It makes you feel fluid, strong, in the pink of health, both mental and physical. It makes you feel very certain about things. Doubt is vanquished, and euphoria comes on in its earliest stages. Who can turn away from this? Who would turn away from this? So it's very devilish in that way, is that it brings you in, and then of course within a matter of days or weeks at the most, it fragments, and you are thrown into an abyss of estrangement and complete confusion. So Sally has had to become, she dreads her manic attacks and really tries to forestall them, and very much values her moments of health.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Michael Greenberg. We're talking with him about his memoir, Hurry Down Sunshine. The book tells the story of what happened in the summer and early fall of 1996 when Michael Greenberg's daughter, Sally, then 15 years old, was struck mad. That's how her dad puts it. And he says Sally's illness marked a turning point in both their lives. He says it was like being, in his words, in the presence of a rare force of nature, such as a great blizzard or flood, destructive, but in its way, astounding, too. Hurry Down Sunshine, the book we're talking about this afternoon. Again, Michael Greenberg, our guest. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. As you're talking about the book with people, as you're out meeting people and talking with them about that, this book, and it's been out now for a while, and a portion of it appeared in the magazine, Oprah's magazine. What kind of response are you getting from people who are familiar with the story in some sense or have read the book?
I get very, very powerful and personal responses from people. I was just on a reading. The book's been out about a month. I was just on a reading tour out west, and people would come up to me and thank me, in some cases, for writing the book. And in a gush of what feels like pent up and what has been long suppressed desire, tell me a story that is similar to Sally's about their parents, one of their parents or their spouse or their best friend or their brother or sister or their uncle. And it's quite extraordinary. And I listen, and which is all I can do. And I'm glad to have triggered this. I feel, you know, that somehow it perhaps is having a purgative effect on some of the readers. It's amazing how widespread mental illness is in terms of when one thinks of it's hard to think of a person that hasn't been touched by it in one way or another. And so I get a lot of that, and then sometimes I get people who were, you know, when you write nonfiction, when you write a memoir, in which I'm not really a memoirist type person. This is a story about a single summer. It's not my impulse to want to write about my life in detail. So this is unusual. It's called a memoir, but I think of it as something else because it's really about one particular event. And you know, people feel, unlike with fiction, people feel like they own a memoir because it's real experience, and everyone's had real experience. So they feel, so you get a, so I get responses that are very kind of judgmental sometimes, and which is okay, because I also understand the impulse of that, and the story has greater power for being true. And why didn't you see it? How could you not tell that your daughter was ill? How could you write about your family like this? Sometimes those kinds of responses.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't have that response to the book, but very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about this book is it is so, it is as if I was with you. It is so moment to moment. It's present. We are in the present tense. And, you know, I was thinking about you and Sally in that summer. She was fevered with words. And I wonder how this book came to you, how it, the words got on the page. Did you feel something similar as you wrote Hurried Down Sunshine? Did you feel fevered with this story?
Yes, I did. I did. It's very interesting that you say that. And as I was writing it, I realized that in some way I was taking on Sally's state at the time from this later, you know, from the promontory of these later years of 10 years later or 9 years later, and I was in some ways intoxicated with Sally and what happened, and as I was then, and you know, it's very exhilarating to write about something that you care about a great deal. Very often as a writer, you're writing an essay, you're writing something that you're assigned, you're writing something that you've created but you're trying to care about. In this case, I was writing about something that meant a huge amount to me and that had really changed my life. And so, yes, there was a feverish imperative in a way.
Hmm. What's the significance of the title?
Well, the significance of the title, it comes from an old blues song, which I think Jimmy Rushing used to sing, called Going to Chicago. And guy in the South, and he's in his backwater, miserable southern town, and he's going to Chicago the next day, and he can't wait for the sun to go down. He says, hurry down, sunshine, see what tomorrow brings, so he can get the hell out and go to Chicago. And I took that phrase, hurry down, sunshine, which stuck with me, and to me, in terms of the book, what it means is it's hurry away. You know, mania is a kind of a bright, scorching sun. You can liken it to the sort of sun that destroys and that withers. It's a brightness without shadow, without nuance, that overcomes the manic person. And so it's the counterintuitive sun. It's not the sun that we bathe in, that nourishes us. So the title, Hurry Down Sunshine, is for the scorching sunlight to go away and for the milder warmth of our normal lives to return.
Mm. In this story, in this book, Hurry Down Sunshine, you introduce us to your brother, Steve, among other family members. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that you care very much for him and he for you, and you take care of him. And you tell a story early in the going about taking him to the grocery store. And just before you part to go your own ways, he tells you he's trying to hack it. Would you tell us that story?
Yes, absolutely. Steve is my older brother. He's 5 years older than I am. And after the death of our father, I began taking care of him and shopping for him every week and making sure he had the things he needs. He's able to live alone, but he has severe social problems that make it difficult for him to work. And this was shortly after the death of our father, and he was very much agitated, feeling that in some ways his great protector in the world had left and no one would replace him, and he was kind of cut loose. And it created a crisis for him at the same time that Sally was having that very same summer in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him, as per usual, for our shopping, and found him to be in a very agitated state, and he was saying, "I can hack it, Michael. I can hack it." And what he was saying was that here's a man who has been unable to successfully have friendships in his life. Our father always used to say, "You know, you can't have friends. You've never had friends." And this was the great kind of curse of Steve's life, and he was saying that now he was making friends, and he could hack it, and he was going to show our father posthumously, and he was going to show me and everyone else, and most importantly himself, that he could hack it, because the friends he made were people who lived on the street near his apartment, who took advantage of him, who used his apartment as a place to crash. And Steve spiraled into a downspin as well that summer.
Yeah. I was struck in that anecdote by his tenacity. And, you know, one might raise the question, you know, what is courage?
Yes. Yes, what is courage? Exactly. Courage is being able to withstand many different things,
yeah,
and to be able to confront them, not just saving a life in a fire. Courage sometimes to be able to confront your own life, especially in the case of these kinds of handicaps. And I do think that Steve does have a lot of courage, and he was trying to climb out of his abyss, even though he knew, even as he was doing it, that he wouldn't be able to make it. There was a sense when he said, "I can hack it, and you'll see, and I don't need you anymore, Mikey," as he called me. And he tried to vanquish me from his life, banish me from his life, even though I was his lifeline. And there was a kind of attempt to assert himself as a functioning and an enriched human being. But he didn't know how to go about it. So there was some courage there. And there's a great deal of courage in Sally's confrontation of her condition as well. I mean, the whole experience of being so close to this has really sensitized me to the fragility of all of us, and the kind of fragility of meaning, even again back to that trick of agreement. So it's been quite extraordinary.
A listener is waiting to talk with us, so let's go and take this call. Our guest this afternoon, Michael Greenberg, writer, author most recently of Hurry Down Sunshine. Our listener is waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. A couple of comments, but first a question. I may have missed part of this, but you haven't, I don't believe, touched too much on her treatment and diagnosis and what medications were used and so forth. And in the comments, you mentioned that she believed that we were all geniuses and so forth, and if we were in touch with our human potential. That's a fairly common idea. It's just not taken, it just doesn't seem to, I mean, it seemed to overwhelm her, or she had a really experiential, I don't know, experience with it. But I'm reading a book called A Blue Hand, and it touches on Ginsberg's so-called psychotic break, or however you want to define it. It's not terribly different when he thought he heard Blake reciting poetry and it had a vision of God. That's one comment. And another comment, when you mentioned Lowell, the poet, if I got that correct, with his tingling along the spine, there's an interesting Oriental concept or Indian concept about a kundalini or energy force at the base of the spine, which is, that's somewhat descriptive of that. And I'll just hang up and listen, but a certain comment I have to make, I think her condition, without knowing anything, having read the book or even heard of it, would have just eventually worked itself out. But that's my own opinion. But I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you for that. That's very interesting. I'm familiar with Allen Ginsberg, the poet's description of his break, where he believed he heard the voice of Blake. It's true that this insight that we're all geniuses is not in itself astonishing and doesn't constitute madness at all. But it wasn't the content of it. It was the way she was experiencing it. So it was a matter of behavior. It was a matter of how she was behaving, which was extremely agitated and, as I say, transformed, possessed in a certain way. So while the psychiatric case books are filled with cases of religious mania and poetic mania and all kinds of insights, it's not the content itself. It's the way it strikes the person and what it does to the person. And it becomes the fulcrum for which to, you know, mania, depression, these are things that are belong to the human spectrum in general, and we all have moments of milder mania, milder depression. And so really these are states that are on the extreme end of what it is to be human. So I think there's a great deal to learn from them, about ourselves even. And part of their mystery is, in somewhere in part of the mystery of what these conditions are, is a lesson to us. And I'm not sure how, but we dig at it. And I believe there's much to learn about who we are. Now, Sally's medical, the way to treatment, she needed to be wrenched out of psychosis. There are cases from the 19th century where people in florid mania don't sleep for 6 months and actually drop dead from exhaustion. So she's in a medical crisis when she's in mania. And she needed to be wrenched out of it by the use of antipsychotic medication, very blunt medication. Haloperidol was what she was given. And under the influence of that medication, another transformation occurs where she's living outside the experience of her life. She's kind of like, I liken it to a cat wriggling in a zippered bag. Her mania is tamped down, but it's still wriggling. It's still kind of agitating. And yet she's been wrenched out by this medication, which is kind of a chemotherapy of the brain. And it's a very difficult treatment, and it's very hard on the person undergoing it. And it takes a while. It takes months before she can come to. Now, the idea that the caller mentions, that this is just something that then writes itself, in almost every case, this is not so. Manic depression, which is what Sally was diagnosed with, bipolar 1, as we call it. I prefer the term manic depression because I think it says something about it more. It's more descriptive. Is a chronic condition that people have to contend with. So Ginsberg was lucky. And Ginsberg presents it as an artistic awakening more than a psychotic break. So, unfortunately, it's not a one-time event in almost all cases.
Hmm. Maybe you would talk with us a little bit about your experience with psychiatrists.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of psychiatrists. There's the psychopharmacologist who was at the hospital, who's treating everyone on the ward or half the patients on the ward, who wants to see you in 90 seconds, give you your antipsychotic medication, see how you're doing by the quickest of interviews and watching you and observation, very quick observation, and moves on. And then post-hospital, Sally had a very gifted psychiatrist who helped her tremendously. Our goal when she got out of the hospital in late July or early August, after about 3 weeks, was for her to start school again. It was for her to be well enough to go to school. And this psychiatrist, her name was Dr. Lensing, was extremely gifted in entering Sally's state and yet guiding her through its symptoms, letting her know that this is what's expected, weaning her from her medication, putting her back on when things got shaky again, talking to her with a kind of an understanding. And between Dr. Lensing and Pat, Sally was able to crawl back to a semblance of herself, a new self in a way, and start school, which was quite miraculous, in September. So there's a wide range of what a psychiatrist can be and can do.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lensing is clearly a good physician, a good doctor. And part of that is, it's interesting that you mentioned Pat again. Again, another very perceptive person. And I was very interested in reading that part of this story where she is talking with you, Dr. Lensing, about Sally. And she sees that Sally is looking to be out in the world again. She doesn't want to be isolated. But she also, Dr. Lensing, realizes that Sally's still attached to her mania. And And then there's also another interesting insight Dr. Lensing has is about voices. And we're running out of time here, but maybe you'd like to say something about these insights and what they meant to you.
Yes, well, they meant a huge amount. They were so explanatory of what of they sort of broke the storm that had hit us down and made us understand it and made Sally understand it. She was attached to her mania, and this is not unusual in psychosis. People in psychosis become attached to it because it puts them at the center of the universe. The voices, the fixations, all have that person at the center of a vast, energized system, a system of the person's own creation and invention, but nevertheless at the center. And so there's a kind of a high to it, and it's hard to give it up. When Dr. Lensing told us that Sally was hearing voices, which sometimes happens with acute mania, and which makes it rather difficult to distinguish from schizophrenia in its early stages, Sally, she actually said she thought this was a good thing because it heartened her because of what the voices were telling Sally. They were telling her to move outward, that Sally's drive to communicate had not vanished, but in fact was staying with her, because one of the terrible things with mental illness is a proclivity to withdraw. Mm. So Dr. Lensing was finding in symptoms that one would normally think of as alarming and deteriorating, she was finding areas of hope and remission in them. So it was quite insightful of her. Mm. And she was right.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Michael Greenberg, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon and talking with us.
Thank you, Celeste.
Michael Greenberg is the author of Hurry Down, Sunshine. The book is published by Other Press. 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City here with those numbers. Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. This morning, USDA released its crop production report. Those numbers we'll get to during the closing mark report, but weren't traded for very long. As attention again turns towards New York and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the financial crisis that's gripping the United States and the rest of the planet. So we'll start in the outside markets this afternoon. Just give you a quick update on where the Dow happens to be at this moment. It's a 15-minute delay on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So these numbers are a little bit late, but not too terribly bad. 8,081, down 495 points for the Dow Jones Industrial Average at this time. Now let's take a look at the numbers in Chicago for the day. Nearby December wheat futures traded the soft red winter wheat in Chicago down 41 and a quarter cents. 5.91 and three quarters was the high on the late day. The low at 5.57 and three quarters. The settlement price at 5.63 and a half, down 41 and one quarter. March contract 6.18 and a quarter. The high. The low at 5.79 and one half. Settlement price at 5.83 and three quarters, down 42 and a quarter on the day. And the May futures in the wheat pit, 6.37 and a half. The high. The low at 5.93 and a half. A settlement price there in the May contract for the wheat, 5.97 and a half, down 43 and a quarter. July futures, 44 cents lower, 6.54. The high. The low at 6.07. Settlement price at 6.10 and a half, down 44 cents on the afternoon. December corn futures, 30 cents lower today, down the limit, 4.29 the high. Low at 4.08 and a quarter. A settlement price at 4.08. And a quarter, down 30 cents for the day. March contract, 450, the high at the low at 425 and three quarters. Settlement price at 425 and three quarters, down that 30-cent limit. And the May futures in the corn pit, down the limit, as well as all the contracts in the corn pit were. 460 and a half, the high, the low and settlement price at 437 and one half, down 30 cents. July futures, 471 and a quarter, the high, the low and settlement price at 448 and a quarter, down 30. In September, 481 and a half, the high, the low at 453 and a quarter. That was also the settlement price for the September corn. December next year, down the 30-cent limit. Final trade for the day and the low at 460 and a half, a settlement price there, but the high at 484 and three quarters. The December 2009 contract settled and the low at 30 lower at 460 and a half. December oat futures down 19 cents today. 293 and three quarters, the high, the low at 78 and a half, a settlement price there, down 19 cents. In the October futures for the oats, 310 and three quarters, the high, the low at 296, and settlement price at $2.95.5, down 19 on the afternoon. Soy complex now, November beans, $9.55 the high, the low in the settlement price at $9.10, down 70. January futures, $9.70 the high, the low at $25.5, and a settlement price at $25.5, down that 70-cent trading limit. March soybeans, $9.98 the high, the low at $9.39.5, settled on the low, down 70. All the contracts in the bean pit were limit lower today. May futures at $9.96.75 top, bottom at $49.75, settled on that low, down 70 cents. And July contract in the bean pit, $9.93.5 the high, the low at $57.5, settlement price there, down 70 cents for the day. Next year's November soybeans, 2009, $9.81 the high, the low at $9.42, settled on that low, down 70 cents. October bean meal, $2.56 the high, the low at $243 a ton, settlement price at $251.20, down $19.70. December bean meal, $273.20 the high, the low at $256, settled on net low, down $20. October bean oil futures, $36.95 the high, the low at $36.23. Bean oil settled, $36.50, down $2.94. And December, $39.29 the high, the low at $37.29. Settlement price on that low at $37.29, down $2.50. During the closing market report, Harvest Hour edition this afternoon, we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo about the commodity markets and the futures. Bruce Bostard will join us to discuss the cash grain market. And then in the second half hour, we'll talk with Glenn Ring of Glenn Ring Enterprises. For those of you who had the privilege of being at our all-day Ag Outlook meeting in March, Glenn Ring stood up in the middle of that meeting and said it's all over. He was watching the technical picture. We'll see what he has to say today about the commodity and financial markets. That's all happening during the closing market report this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now let's take a look at what happened today in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange with a livestock contract. Cattle were down the limit today, live and feeder cattle. Lean hogs also finished lower on the day today. October live cattle, $89.95, the high, the low, and the settlement today, $89.12.5, that down $3. December, $92.60, the high, $91.30, the low, and settlement, that down the limit. February, $93.10, the high, $91.82.5, the low, and settlement, down $3. April, $93.65 the high, $92.45 the low, the settlement, $92.45, that down $3. October feeder cattle, $96.90 the high, the low, and the settlement today, $95.45, down $3. November, $96.10 the high, $95.05 the low, and settlement, that down $3. January, $96.20 the high, $95.05 the low, and settlement, that down $3. And March, $97.00 the high, $96.40, the low, and settlement, that down the limit. October lean hog, $66.75, the high, $65.50, the low, the settlement, $66.00, that down $97.50. December, $60.80, the high, $59.50, the low, the settlement, $59.87.50, that down $1.25. February, $65.30, the high, the low, $64.27.50, the settlement today, $64.97.50, down $157.50. And April lean hog, $70.70, the high, $69.35, the low, the settlement, $70.25, that down $2.10. And February bellies, $86.60, the high, $85.25, the low, the settlement, $86.47.50, that down $177.50. The Dow currently off 518 points at 8,062. The NASDAQ off 83 at 1,562. The S&P 500 off 57 at 852.